Welcome to the Daily French Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you? How's Pretoria? How's life?
Yeah, I'm well. Pretoria is great. Still the administrative capital of a formerly racist, oppressive nation. And, you know, life generally is continuing despite all the odds. So,
indeed. And Mr. Maurice Root. Maurice, how are you?
How's Nick? How's it, Herman?
Right, so let us get into the story of today, and that is a scandal that's engulfing the Democratic Alliance, or the DA, as we call it, and that is that one of the senior members of the DA, a guy called Bongi Nkosi Madikizela, who is the leader of the DA in the Western Cape, and is also a candidate for the DA's mayoral, is someone competing to be the DA's mayoral candidate for Cape Town, has been accused of lying on his CV about holding a BCom degree in human resources. According to reports in the media, Madikizela gave the DA a CV that he submitted to the mayor when he applied to be mayor, which said that he held a BCom degree in human resources, but actually he only, I think, had a few years, like 2 years, and didn't complete the degree. Madikizela said, quote, "It is true that I did not finish my BCom degree. Having a degree or not did not advantage me in any of the positions that I'm currently occupying. I previously applied for the premier position, that's premier of the Western Cape, and now for position to become Cape Town mayor, and a tertiary qualification was never a requirement for a political position in South Africa." So he's currently, I believe, an MEC in the Western Cape government, and Western Cape Premier Alan Windey said, "I'm deeply concerned by allegations that Minister Madikizela's biography contains information which is not true, as well as claims that he misled a journalist in this regard, and welcome that this matter is being urgently investigated to determine the facts. I'll be also meeting with Minister Madikizela later today to discuss the matter." So this issue has been referred to the DA's Federal Legal Commission, which will, it says, investigate the accusations and determine whether any sort of sanctions should be applied. Of course, the ANC, the ANC's leader in the Western Cape Legislature, Cameron Dugmore, said that Madikizela should be suspended because he lied about his CV. So let me start with you, Herman. What do you make of this? How serious of an offense is this? And should Bongi Nkosi Madikizela be sanctioned for this by the DA if it turns out to be true?
Well, I think the issue has several levels. And I do think that Mr. Madikizela is being disingenuous when he says tertiary qualification was never a requirement for any position he'd applied to, because that's true, but that's not the problem. The problem isn't there's a brouhaha because he doesn't have a BCom degree. That's not the issue. The problem is that he lied about having one, or is alleged to have lied about having
one. Although, as we just discussed before the show, there are people who are trying to make it about the fact that he doesn't have a qualification, apart from the lying. As Mario said, there were people on social media making fun of him, and someone even claiming that the DA is apparently the party for non-graduates because DA leader John Steenhuisen doesn't have a degree.
But Mr. Madikizela is one of those people. He is leading on that discussion. So he's being incredibly dangerous. And I think he knows this. He knows the issue isn't, does he have a degree or not? Is a degree needed for the position he's applying or not? This is a very convenient, I think, diversion tactic from where I'm sitting to say, but it doesn't matter. But that's not the problem. And I think he is feeding a very toxic fire if he's going to say that, you know, it's about me not having a degree, it's about me not having a degree. No, it's nonsense. It's not about Mr. Madikizela not having a degree. It's about him saying he has one, or allegedly saying he has one when he doesn't. It's not about the crime, it's about the cover-up. It's not about the reality, it's about the honesty. And now the problem is politicians never get to seem to get this right. It's the cover-up, it's the lying, it's the dishonesty that always gets you in the end. People can forgive a hell of a lot of stuff from politicians. I mean, Bill Clinton is and Donald Trump are examples of this. But the thing that often really rankles and that gives ammunition to political opponents inside your own party or externally is the fact that you lied about something. As we also discussed earlier, this is, you can't divorce this from politics. There's some politics going on here, quite obviously, because there is this race for the DA mayoralty of Cape Town, and Madiki Zela is a candidate. And I wouldn't be surprised for one moment if this had been known for quite some time, but one of the political opponents had been sitting on this information waiting for a good moment to weaken Mr. Madiki Zela. So he made his bed, and it's unfortunate that there is this politicking. But if he lied about his qualification, he lied about his qualification. And it's not just an internal party matter. In terms of the National Qualifications Framework Act of 2019, lying about your qualifications could, is a criminal offense, liable to a fine or imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years. So I think we must be very clear what the problem is, what it isn't. Mr. Madiki Zela is not helping the clarity of matters by making this about whether he has a degree or not. That's not the problem.
But Morris, do you have anything to add to that? Do you agree with Herman's take on this?
Yeah, I do. But also, I think this also shows the kind of fetishization that we have in South Africa of qualifications and so on. Like, a degree isn't the be-all and end-all, and having a degree or not doesn't say anything about you as a human being. All it tells you is that you have the resources to go to university, whether through a bursary or you've lacked enough for people, or your parents pay for it or whatever, and you manage to, you know, regurgitate stuff in an exam and so on. So it doesn't say anything about Mr. Madiki Zela's the abilities or anything like that. So I'm sure he's still a very competent person. I mean, he's become the leader of the DA in the Western Cape. And I think this is, as I said, this is part of the fetishization of qualifications where, you know, and it's kind of this glut of qualifications. People need to, have to get degrees, and often they degrees that actually aren't all that useful for themselves or for society. But yeah, but as Harriman makes the point, it's about the fact that Mr. Madiki Zela lied about not having qualification. And I mean, it's obviously not great that he lied, but I mean, I don't think, like, I do think he needs to face some form of punishment, as I think you mentioned before, Nick, perhaps needs to step down from leadership positions in the party for now, maybe a public apology or whatever the case is. But I mean, and the DA also seems to be held to a much higher standard than other parties. I mean, we've seen Ace Magashule, who, I mean, it seems pretty open and shut case that he's been involved in criminal activity in the Free States. I mean, from stealing a PUDF patent to being involved in massive corruption at the Estina Dairy, for example, and, you know, all kinds of other things. And everybody's like, oh, cool, he's just going to, you know, he's going to hang around for another 30 days. He probably won't stand down at the end of it. You know, and most of the people who are going on about Mr. Madiki Zela probably wouldn't vote for the DA anyway. But that said, though, I don't think this should be swept on the carpet. It is... he did make a mistake by lying about having a qualification, and there has to be some form of punishment. But I don't think this should be the end of his political career, or nor the end of his career in the DA.
Right, I pretty much agree with that, with both of your takes. This is a serious thing, and of course, as Herman points out, the lie is bad. Lying in a position like this, lying about your qualifications is something that you should take very seriously. And I think he probably should step down from leadership positions. But so long as the voters give him another chance inside the DA or from the general public, then maybe he should take another shot of it in a few years. But there should definitely be some sort of sanction. I assume that the facts aren't going to be too much contested, because he's basically said that it's true that he didn't finish his BCom degree.
But one thing, Nick, that I it was reported about an hour ago before we started recording that Madiki Zela has been suspended for 14 days pending an investigation by Premier Windy after their meeting yesterday, so that is a development here. It is an escalation, as it were, of the situation.
Has he been suspended from the provincial cabinet or from the DA?
from the provincial cabinet by Premier Windy. So
still dear leader of the Western Cape and whatever.
Yes, I don't think any decision on that has been taken. Windy certainly doesn't have the power to change that position he holds. So that's the one thing. And the second thing that I just think we should also add to this is that Mr. Madikizela is playing a very dangerous game. If he is going to continue making this about, I don't have a qualification, but I'm still qualified or I'm still up to the task, he knows that's a dishonest distortion of the situation. And his party, with the situation of John Steenhuisen not having a degree, is being made unnecessarily vulnerable to some bizarre form of criticism that the DA, you know, is for the underqualified or the unqualified. And ironically, Nick, as you pointed out, were that the case, they would mightly, you know, win a majority at the next election.
Right.
The majority of South Africans don't have degrees.
Indeed. If the DA is the party for non-graduates, it would win overwhelmingly in an election.
Yes, and it would be probably a more trustworthy party. I say that as someone with, you know, one unit, two type of nonsensey stuff. But Madikizela is playing a very dangerous game. He knows his party leader and, by extension, his party is vulnerable on this qualification point. To make it about whether he has a qualification or not is going to make life very awkward for John Steenhuisen.
Right. Now, I do agree with that, but I will say that at least some of that is, as I mentioned earlier, because there has been this public reaction to it, particularly from people in the EFF orbit, either sort of online supporters of the EFF or sometimes from EFF leaders as well. I mean, I know that they've made a lot of hay out of the fact that John Steenhuisen doesn't have a tertiary qualification. And they contrast with themselves. They like to claim to be the party of education, and they have, you know, what's it? Ndlozi did his
doctorate.
His doctorate recently, and so the EFF is always referring to him as Dr. Ndlozi. And
I think Floyd Chibambu's also recently got his degree as well, his doctorate.
Maurice
is absolutely right about the fetishization or whatever, however you pronounce that.
Fetishization.
That one. Sorry, I don't have much experience with. I don't have as much experience with that as you do, Maurice. But I think if you look,
fetish has more than one meaning, Harriman, and the fact that
if the situation here is that, you know, it's this undeserved shine that a tertiary qualification gives you. I mean, most of the EFF's people with these high sounding degrees are about as useful as a knitted condom. It really isn't a question of qualification in South Africa, and that's what frustrates me so fundamentally. South Africa will get much, much further if we stop this nonsense with tertiary education. But it's not a panacea.
Right, and so I'm not afraid to say that if the you know, if the EFF ran this country, it would probably be a living hellscape within a year. whereas if Steenhuisen ran the country, there would probably be still many issues, but it wouldn't be a post-apocalyptic Venezuelan style wasteland. So tertiary education really doesn't get you much in terms of quality of leadership, I think.
Well, to make a silly comparison, Abraham Lincoln was famously he didn't have any formal education. He's pretty much seen as the greatest leader the United States has ever had, while Robert Mugabe had something like 7 university degrees. I mean, that's obviously facetious comparison, but
Jan Smuts, he only had 2 or 3 or 4 years of schooling, arguably one of the most intelligent statesmen of the
20th century. He went to Oxford, man. Oh, yeah, got school in anyway, Oxford. Yes. I thought you said
No. I mean, well, Oxford, what's that?
Cambridge. You went to Oxford or Cambridge, whatever, one of the two.
Is it like old form of Nando's? But the point is, education is not the same as competence. It's really as simple as that.
If Jan Smuts was really smart, he would have gone to Wits or Tux or Rau, a proper university.
He wouldn't have lost in 1948, but that's the thing.
So I think one of the reasons why South Africa, particularly in its sort of online sphere and in that sort of EFF sphere, is that it fetishizes education so much, is because South Africa is a very difficult place to get by, and if you don't have that tertiary qualification, because it is fetishized, it's a reinforcing cycle here where degrees are fetishized because high school is not valued, because it's not considered credible. People have to get degrees, and then you don't get a job unless you have a degree. And so it sort of creates this vicious cycle of the importance of tertiary education being inflated over and over. And that's a direct consequence of, firstly, our high school education being of low quality, and secondly, of the lack of jobs in the country. That means that you have to really be a very attractive candidate to be employed most of the time, because otherwise you're going to just sit collecting a grant.
But, I mean, you also don't want to say, I mean, downplay the importance of education. I mean, it's a fact. If you have a degree, you are far more likely to be employed in South Africa, and you're going to earn far more than somebody who doesn't have a degree or didn't finish high school.
Right. But,
and I get you saying that. We'll tell you. And there is correlation, I've seen, between GDP levels and average years of education per people in a country, or whatever the case is. So, but obviously, just because you've been in formal education for 20 years and everybody in the country has been in formal education for 20 years, whatever, that doesn't mean, right. I mean, obviously, what you've been, and there's all kinds of other things that are important in the place.
This is a debate that I think, you know, maybe we should have another time that's to flesh it up more fully about what exactly the role education has in developing a healthy country is. But I think it's worth pointing out there's a lot of countries that are worse. Have worse education, at least, you know, in terms of numbers of high school attendees and all that kind of thing, than South Africa, that do much better economically. Yes. And in fact, I wonder how often education sort of follows the growth in GDP, because if people have economic opportunities, you know, they can make sure their children have all the right learning stuff, the children don't have to drop out of school to work, there's more jobs, stuff like that.
I think, Nick, you're absolutely right. That's why I always draw a distinction between skills development and education, because low-level employment is probably the greatest opportunity for skills development, for economic productivity and life-improved circumstances. Because the inverse of what you're saying is also true. Remember, Zimbabwe has far superior numeracy and literacy rates than we do. So I think that there's a duality of problems here. Firstly, I think it is a status thing as well, that tertiary education has become an unhealthy thing, like a status, a symbol.
And not just in South Africa, across the world.
Across the world, but I think especially in poorer parts of South Africa, very similar to expensive cars that people just simply can't afford and that they can't drive, but it's just, you know, got a car, got a BMW, so I have arrived. So the number one thing is, I think there's a problematic status associated with it, and the inverse of it is being, you know, statusless if you're underqualified, which is dangerous. And the second thing is, I think this, I don't want to blame this on colonialism or apartheid, but I do think that there was this bizarre confusion as to the correlation between education and economic productivity, that white people in South Africa really experienced throughout, especially from the 1922, you know, Apprenticeship Act. The whole system was just skewed by this idea of worthy people and worthy economic participation and clients and customers. So we're sitting in this situation where I think if we could get back to making skills rather than qualifications the basis for employment, we'd be a hell of a lot better off than we are now.
But I just want to make a point on the issue of status, and I think you're right there, Herman, but I think it's also partly linked to the history of our country. I remember during the Fees Must Fall uprisings from a couple of years ago, one of the chants, and I saw it on a couple of posters, was people say would say, my mother was a tea girl, my father was a garden boy. You know, and it's kind of, you know, and for a lot of black people, that was, you know, doesn't matter what you did, you were kind of condemned to this life of, you know, just being a laborer sort of, and you didn't have the opportunity to go to decent school and university, no matter how hard you worked and how much initiative you had. So I think that's also part of it to show, like, you know, you've got past this.
Definitely.
I mean, so it's a very deeper psychological issues around this too.
Right, that's definitely part of the equation here. But I do think we have followed a global trend beyond our own history in fetishizing these things. But anyway, that's a very complicated topic, and I think we should move on for now. But I think it's worth returning to. And we're going to talk now about the great love of Maurice's life, which is, of course, cricket in South Africa. And
why are you going to say there for a while, geez?
Yeah, especially having just had a conversation about fetishes and things.
So Cricket South Africa, which of course is the governing body of cricketing in South Africa, has admitted that they failed as an organization to eradicate racial discrimination within the Proteas national team over the years. They said in a statement, "We as the National Federation accept that as much as we agitated for redress and transformation, we were not successful in eradicating the creation of some players in favored positions, pushing black players into the margins and not providing fairness and justice for all." This is from their interim board on Tuesday. Now, we've covered this several times in the show, but they've recently had an enormous number of issues with their leadership and management, and there's been lots of fighting. So that's why there's an interim board making this statement. The Cricket South Africa Transformation Committee, as mandated by the board to establish the Office of Transformation Ombudsman, has progressed to a stage where this office can now receive complaints and or submissions from former players, current players, coaches, administrators, and stakeholders, reads the statement. So they are encouraging people to make statements to this ombudsman about problems with transformation, and they say they will address them. Maurice, what exactly is... what do you think of Cricket SA's declaration and solution for the problems they're talking about?
To be honest, I found it hard that there's this racist movement in the coaches, and you know, people have Ku Klux Klan hood in their bag with their cricket bats and pads and so on. You know, so, and also you'd think people who have made the coaches are, they get made aware of what they're representing and the country that they're representing and the history of the country and so on. But at the same time, you also don't want to diminish people's experiences. We had Makhaya Ntini come out, I think last year, saying how he'd been mistreated in the protest team. But also take what Makhaya Ntini said with quite a big pinch of salt. He also said when he was dropped, how upset he was and how he'd really wanted to break the record for most test wickets by a South African. But to me, that smacked a bit of entitlement. As a professional sportsman, you have no right to be in a team. You have to be performing. And when Makhaya Ntini was dropped, if you look at the statistics, and if you know cricket, you can see how his pace had dropped. He wasn't taking wickets. It was right that he was dropped at the time. And also, Makhaya Ntini also came out and said how he never had any support from Cricket South Africa when he was playing. And that's also complete nonsense. Makhaya Ntini was convicted of rape in 1998 or 1999. And the South African Cricket Board at the time, with Ali Bacha, stood by him. They pulled him out of the teams. Obviously, he was supposed to go to the World Cup in 1999, but didn't because of that conviction. He won an appeal, was found innocent, and he went and had a great career for South Africa. He's one of the greatest sportsmen that's ever played for this country. But also, when he was coming out to these accusations, Sony was saying he never had any support. But when he retired in 2011, I remember I actually found an article when he was saying this kind of stuff, because my recollection was completely different. And he said, you know, he wants to thank people like Dr. Ali Bacha, Sean Pollock, people who really stood by him during his career and, you know, made him the cricketer that he is. And just strange that a couple of years later, he claims that, that the protesters were actually a bunch of, RVBS sympathizers or whatever the case is. So it's also about, at the same time, you don't want to diminish a guy's experience, and if you felt like that, but also was it because of racism? I've read quite a lot of cricket biographies in my life, and a lot of them often talk about how there were cliques in different teams. I mean, for example, a guy like Geoffrey Boycott, who used to play for England, he was completely despised by his colleagues in the teams. That's just because he was an unpleasant guy. So maybe, I mean, were they racist against Yorkshiremen? No, you just didn't like Geoff Boycott because he was a nice person. No, I'm not saying, obviously, Makhaya Ntini was nice. But also cliques develop in teams. Others have all spoken about the clique that developed between Graham Smith, Mark Boucher, and Jacques Callis, and how people felt excluded. And that includes white players, black players, colored players. And that often happens in a strong team like that. It'll be built around a core of players who happen to be Graham Smith, Jacques Callis, and Mark Boucher. And people often feel excluded. So, but I mean, this also seems to be... You know, this kind of seems to be a window dressing thing. Talking about transformation, when we talk about the protests, also any protest team picked now is on merit is going to be pretty transformed. You know, whichever way you want to use the term, but we have to talk about. I've spoken about this in the show before. It's transformation at grassroots. I mean, there was somebody put on Twitter the other day the average price of cricket bats. And one cricket bat was 12,000 Rand. Obviously, you can get cricket bats for much cheaper than that. But, I mean, 12,000 Rand is more than most people in South Africa make in a month. And there's also the fact that only 6% of government schools in South Africa have cricket facilities. So we can talk about transformation until we're blue in the face, until these things change. And even the black players that are in the protest team at the moment, Kagiso Rabada is not underprivileged. He went to St. Stithians. His father's a doctor. His mother's a lawyer. Themba Bavuma is the same. His dad was a journalist, also went to a good school. Lungi Ngidi went to Built in College of Belief, but he does come from a poorer background. His parents, I think his father was a gardener and his mother a domestic worker. Apparently when Nungengidi made his test debut in Centurion, his parents flew up from Natal to come see him. First time they'd ever been on a plane. So that's not just, but I mean, he managed to use his cricketing ability to become relatively privileged, went to a very good school, and now he plays for the Proteas. So, you know, and cricket is inherently a sort of a privileged game. You need good coaching to make it to the top. You need obviously the equipment, which I just mentioned. So I do think Cricket South Africa is, as usual, barking up the wrong tree. I mean, if this is an important issue, then they need to look into it. But I really don't think this is the main problem South African cricket faces. And if we want cricket to become a truly national game in South Africa, I mean, that's where you've got to, any kid who wants to play cricket in South Africa should be able to have the opportunity. They should have the equipment. They should have a place to go play and practice. And they should have coaching as far as possible.
That's a difficult act to follow, Herman, because it was spoken with such passion. Yes. But do you have any thoughts very briefly before we move on?
Yes. I mean, very briefly, we yesterday lost with nine wickets against Pakistan. And this is what Cricket South Africa is focusing on. I just think it's farcical. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. Especially since 2019, I'm sorry, I upset Oliver Marius. I think especially since the Springboks won the 2019 World Cup with the most racially diverse squad the country's ever had, a squad picked blatantly on merit, as communicated by the coach, under a black captain who saw a country, you know, united behind his leadership. And then two years down the line, still be busy with this nonsense about transformation. How about we focus on the transformation of being South African cricket-less shit? I mean, really, are we saying that precludes the involvement of black cricket players? Is Cricket South Africa really of the opinion that black cricket players are so terrible that they can't be included on merit, and that we have to choose between these two transformations, either from bad cricket to good cricket or white cricket to black cricket? I just think it's appalling. I think it's disgusting. I think, Marius, your summation of Mkhaya Mthini as an opportunist is absolutely bloody spot on. And the whole thing is just, I think it's quite shocking. And Cricket South Africa shouldn't be surprised if they lose permanently or for the foreseeable future the goodwill of all South Africans with the love of the sport.
To be fair to the Proteas, I should make two quick points. We were missing some players for the IPL: Quinton de Kock, Akhisi Rabada, Andrich Nokia, Themba Bavuma's injured, and we did win the last game. We're missing those players with five is remaining. But that said, you are correct, and the transformation requirements also we've seen, like, it also leads to teams being unbalanced, teams being picked. I mean, if anybody who follows cricket will have seen that Andile Pechlukwaya batted at six yesterday and didn't bowl. And I mean, that doesn't do anything for his confidence, because he's more of a bowler than a batsman. And now he's batting as a, and it's because he was picked, he had to play because of transformation requirements, because Lutus Kamla is not really in form at the moment and he's a bowler. So, you know, and I think except for the most rabid race nationalist in South Africa, nobody would care what the team looks like if they're winning. And if we know everybody wants to play has had the opportunity. Obviously, it'd be different if you can't play because of your skin color, whatever it is. But I mean, yeah, that's a different story. So, yeah, but yeah, that's one of these things. Yeah, as Nicholas says, quite passionate about it. And sorry about the dog again.
Yes, no, your dog has a habit of crashing our podcasts. But anyway, yeah, look, so I don't think we have time to go on to our final topic for today, which is just about nuclear power in South Africa, but I'm sure we can come back to it. But, you know, the sort of BEE policies continue to divide South Africans, continue to not actually fix the problems that they're designed to fix. And, you know, cricket, the way that cricket is carrying on in South Africa is just another sign of how that's true.
I just quickly want to say something about Mkhaya Mthini that I actually want to say earlier. You have to choose. Either you're going to be a racial pioneer in the sense that you are entering a known hostile sphere, a known hostile arena, as the first black cricketer of significant merit, and expect prejudice And it's not going to be fun. It's not going to be nice. But you can either claim your icon status with the difficulties that come with it, or you could seek to be shielded from those difficulties. You can't have it both ways. You can't be a pioneering figure, trailblazing the way for black athletes in a white-dominated sport, then complain about the sort of prejudice that you encountered while being proud of having challenged that prejudice. So pick one. Either be the icon of the first black cricket player that broke down these boundaries and be proud of that and wear your battle scars as labels of or marks of honor, medals of honor, or seek to be shielded from the difficulties that you want other people to trailblaze on your behalf. I think the one is heroic and worth of, you know, national pride. The other one is just plain cowardly.
Right. So you've now pushed us over time, but thank you for your passion, please. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We are out of time. We will see you next week. But we do have a special episode of the show tonight at about 8 o'clock tonight. I will be interviewing, along with Gabriel Krause, Helen Ziller, the Federal Council Chairman of the DA. So tune into that. I'm sure it'll be interesting. And this is going to be talking about her new book, which is Stay Woke, Go Broke. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed. And we'll see you next week for the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.